We'd like to do an abbreviated review of the Minnesota Measures Report, including the process, the budget, and the five goals. And we'd like to review a few sample indicators to tell you about the changes planned for the next version of the Minnesota Measures Report for 2009. From there, we'll have Tricia Grimes review the Measuring Up Report, which you also asked about, which was released by the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education, and look at the similarities and the difference between Minnesota and the national report. Does this approach work for you?
Sounds good.
Okay, great. Up here you'll see the process that we worked through. The initial process was really important. Some people kind of poo-poo process, but in this case it was very important that we had a thorough process.
And Ms. Hegard, for people who don't have eyes good enough to see that, there is a handout that we have in our pile.
Closer? Okay. The initial process was important to the responsiveness and the credibility of this project. The five goals came from the process, which included several statewide meetings and 20 smaller meetings of employers and educators across the state. Legislators, agency heads, system heads, and others participated in the initial meetings. And there were a couple principles that I think we felt were really critical to having a process that was viewed as a responsible one, and one was that it was not top-down, it was bottom-up. We engaged the stakeholders, got lots of input, and then built the indicators and the goals up from the ground. And then we wanted to make sure that we provided good, clear, understandable data about Minnesota in the context of the nation and of the rest of the world, and you'll see that as a theme throughout the report. Do you need for me to go through this, or do you just want to kind of...
I think in the interest of time,
yeah, okay.
You don't have to go through it. You can look at it.
So you can see basically it took, we spent about, a year and a half or so kind of on the initial process getting this thing put together. We're pleased to report that this report, Minnesota Measures, has been a topic of interest around the country, and I've been asked on a number of occasions to present it at national conferences. The most common question I get is this: how did you manage to come together and agree on goals and indicators? And here's what I say. First, we were very fortunate to have the support for some money, budget from you that allowed us to do this right. And in its third year, it's still very much a work in progress, which is a good thing. We continue to look at new and different ways of looking at the data, but we've been told that it's a really good start, and we've been advised that by some of the folks that we've met at these various national conferences. Second, we remind ourselves often of our limited role as a state agency. What's our job and what is our job? What is and is not our job. Our job, we believe, is to identify and present indicators that speak to the goals developed by hundreds of people across the state. And we believe the legislature, governors, system governing boards, and college presidents are in the best position to utilize that data to improve higher education in Minnesota. So we hope the data that we present will inform your policy making. So one of the questions that was put forward suggests that the Minnesota report incorporate a grading strategy or a more clear indication of positive or negative progress. You asked, is the state's higher education sector serving the diverse needs of the state? And I guess what I would say is that that's not really a yes and no question. And we also don't feel that it's appropriate for us to issue letter grades. You know, others have tried report cards. When we first met with you and got your input, that was not something that was of interest or what you wanted us to do. And so that's not what we did in this report. We can do a better job always of clarifying what the outcomes mean, and we can provide information that can inform efforts to set targets at various indicators. So, for example, if you wanted to set a target for a graduation rate or a target for retention, that could be done, but it really should be a process that's informed by the data and done, I think, in a collaborative way. The process that we are talking about today led us to these five state goals. The group that we ended up hiring to help us facilitate the process, the National Center for Higher Education Management Systems, or NCHEMS, looked at the goals that came through the process alongside the statutory goals that are in Minnesota statutes and found some common ground. The words are different, but the concepts, they found some general and the thing, again, that we tried to do is we didn't want to take the goals that were in the statute and say, okay, this is how it's going to be. We wanted to see what the stakeholders around the state felt was important and, again, build up from there. We welcome the opportunity to align these goals with statutory goals if that's something you'd like us to do, so just let us know. Another question that was asked of us in the information you put forward is, do the goals need to be revisited on a regular basis? Absolutely. But we'd be surprised and concerned if they change frequently or substantially, and they were developed really to endure. The systems, in particular, asked us not to change them too much because they were in the process of aligning their accountability work with the work that we were doing. We worked very closely with the University of Minnesota and with MinSCU and with the private colleges. Another question that you asked was, how do these goals relate to the system's goals? MinSCU, as I said, has tried to align their dashboard and their strategic goals with what we're doing, and the U of M, there's some congruence there as well. Another question that you asked us is, what's a public agenda for higher education? At the outset of the process, we tapped some national experts, and they use the term public agenda frequently. Without an agenda, without a set of goals, it's hard to tell where we're going and how we're doing. So we believe the five goals represent the beginnings of a public agenda, and if you don't like that terminology, we're very open to other suggestions, but a public agenda for higher education. And the five goals are on the up here, and then you can also read them on your handout. On this slide, you'll see the first goal, which is to improve the success of all students, particularly students from groups traditionally underrepresented in higher education. And we focused in this goal on college participation, retention, graduation, transfer analysis, and enrollment and completion by race and ethnicity and income. So another question you put forward, the data you report with the exception of the achievement gap are reported without relation to race or ethnicity or income. How do the indicators used in the report vary according to these factors? Well, I wanted to just make sure that you all know that we do look at race and ethnicity where it makes sense. We think that's important. So if you look at in the report on page 5 and pages 15 through 19 of the report itself, we've tried to weave the race-ethnicity data for every indicator if it's possible and appropriate. We'll be adding an income component to the 09 report because often you'll see some overlap between income issues, you know, poverty level of children and race ethnicity, or of individuals and race and ethnicity. But it's not always possible to get good income data and race ethnicity data together. What's important about that is that that really can show you a lot about the achievement gap and how it persists. It starts in K-12 and it persists when an individual moves on into higher education. Another question you asked is there a reason to focus on race, ethnicity, and not income when attempting to better understand the challenges facing the state with regard to increasing the success of all students? And we feel it's important to look at the data from all perspectives, race, ethnicity, by income, by type of institution, as well as in the aggregate. All of them are important. Another part of goal one, another indicator, is the retention rate, as I mentioned. And you'll see on this slide we report retention this was last year's report for 05 and 06, a fall for the two public systems and the two private systems. And then we came up with an average. So here's a sample indicator from goal one, the first to second year retention rates at four-year institutions. And for those of you who don't know what that is, it's a percentage of full-time, full-year students who return for a second consecutive year at the same institution. Minnesota's statewide retention rate was 78.8% in 2006, and our four-year retention rate ranks 16th nationally and is slightly above the national average and comparable to our peer states of Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Why does retention matter? Well, it's one indication among many that a student found the right fit and that their needs are being met by the institution. Of course, you have to take into consideration the selectivity level of some schools versus others, but if the admissions and the student support services are functioning optimally and there's a good fit, the students will be retained. What you see here is a breakdown by institution type. So go to page 10 of the report, and you'll see this broken down by individual institution.
This is the actual report?
That's correct.
Okay.
We'll get to the National Measuring Up report in a few minutes. Tricia Grimes will go over that. But what Measuring Up does not do, so if you're wondering, well, why do we need two reports or five reports? I guess one thing we'd say is that it's important, as long as the information's clear, you can really be informed by several different reports. They may tell information in different ways that can be very useful. So what Measuring Up does not do is provide us with the numbers behind the numbers. The story gets lost when everything's aggregated, summarized, and then graded. which is really what they do. And it's hard to identify individual strengths and potential areas for improvement within Minnesota. And this is where we think our report adds value, is that we really break down the information for the state by institution.
Ms. Grimes, I'm just trying to understand this. I'm sorry we were talking, because when I look in the report on page 10, we have, you know, kind of different numbers than when I look at in the summary or the PowerPoint on page 6. So maybe I missed this. You might have said it too fast. Retention at four-year institutions. On page 6 of the PowerPoint, did those numbers indicate they came back for a second year? Is that what the
numbers are indicating on the PowerPoint that the students were from their fall 05 to their fall 06, that 71%, 72% of the students at the state use were retained. And then we try to put that in a national context, you know, with our peer states to show kind of how we sit in relative terms.
So there's two columns. So it was one from 04 to 05 and one from 05 to 06?
Fall of 05 is one point in time, and then fall in 06.
So it's from the previous year. Okay.
Madam Chair, it's for students starting in the fall of 05, continuing in the fall of 06. So if they show up the next fall, they're considered retained if they were a full-time student to begin with.
And then the second column is what?
Starting the fall of 06.
To 07.
To 07.
Okay. Okay, gotcha. Thanks.
This is where it gets interesting. It's kind of a busy slide, this particular slide, but this would be an example of where we try to break the information down by race and ethnicity. You'll see that the darker green color is for full-time four-year students. The lighter green color is for part-time 4 years. The full-time is a yellow. The part-time two-year students is a dark gray, and the non-degree seeking students, those who are just taking some classes, is light gray. So this is another indicator that's important to look at. Note the differences in enrollment patterns between the groups. For example, 32% of all African-American students enrolled in 2006 were enrolled part-time at a two-year college. That's one-third of all the black students, African-American students enrolled. Then look at the white students. Of all the white students enrolled, only 15% are enrolled part-time at a two-year college. So that, I think, is a valuable, you know, it's a place where it shows the difference by race and ethnicity of enrollment of these students, depending upon the type of institution. And measuring up wouldn't tell you something like that. But I guess the question for you then would be, you know, if you wanted us to put a letter grade, how would we put a letter grade on something like that? So our feeling is it's better to present the information in a clear way so that we can have a conversation about it than sort of judging the information.
Okay. Madam Chair, again, members, for the record, my name is Mark Michikanis with the Office of Education. I'm going to kind of work through quickly the next three goals, 2, 3, and 4. Goal 2 talks about a responsive system and actually producing graduates for the demands of the economy. And there are three indicators here, degree attainment, production, alignment, and then I'll survey, and I'll talk through each of these very quickly. Attainment simply means of our population, how many people at certain education levels do we have, whether they're associate degrees, bachelor's degrees, graduate degrees, it doesn't really matter. The important point about this is that people are very mobile, especially highly educated people. Migration matters a great deal. We are a net importer of educated people from other states. That may simply be because the Twin Cities is a kind of an economic magnet for Wisconsin, Iowa, the Dakotas, things like that. But it is important to note that we lose people as well. They're educated here and they leave to go to other states. It's just because it is a mobile society. Degree production focuses more in on what is actually going on in our institutions. Minsky institutions, private colleges, both for a nonprofit, the University of Minnesota. And again, we want to do comparisons because we want to make sure that we can produce what we need here. Migration is important, but sometimes to rely on it is kind of shaking the dice, if you will, because we're not sure that we can actually attract people in all the cases that we may need them. So certainly production is important. Degree alignment is something that we started last year in the second report. We did not have in the first report. We're aware of data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and our local deed agency where they do projections of by occupation, in fact, up to 765 different occupations. And they have educational needs for each of those occupations. So we think it's important to align our production capacity, if you will, in our institutions with the demands of the economy in those occupations. A nurse at certain levels may need an AA or if you're an RN with a BA. So to the extent that, you know, we can identify a shortage, it's helpful to the institutions then to make adjustments in some of their programs. So it's really this alignment between educational needs and the demands of the economy that is informative in this report. What is not in this report that we plan to add in the future is various wage levels for those occupations, because certainly some pay more than others.
Senator Weaker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Sakanis. Applying this to something that the governor mentioned today on teacher preparation, the education programs, I believe now that one superintendent told me they have 200 applicants for an elementary school position, suggesting there's quite a supply out there. And another message today is that the teachers aren't adequately being trained by the governor. How do you apply both those messages to the goal and what we're going to do?
Madam Chair, Senator Weaver, on your first question about the elementary education teachers, I'm well aware of it because my daughter is in elementary at St. Kate's. So it is of concern. It's really hard to tell a student that has a strong desire or passion for an occupation, no, you can't do it. If you recall, 2 years ago, there was a debate with electricians and some of the Minsky programs. It's a hard place to be put in. I think as long as they're aware of the conditions.
Madam Chair, there's a disclosure that you may not, probably will not find a job.
It's hard to find a job. Subsidize it. Yeah. You may have to start someplace else to find a job. You may have to
We're subsidizing this, too. To debate it, but I...
Well, Senator Weaker, you bring up a good point that, you know, maybe this is an area where we're educating too many teachers, and it might be if we don't think it's appropriate for across the board cuts, then maybe Minsky, we need to encourage Minsky to look at if we're trying to align with goals that they agreed to, and there's an oversupply, maybe we have too many teacher ed programs.
But the point then too that the governor just raised an hour or so ago, that we aren't doing an adequate job in the preparation. And
Madam Chair and Senator Weaker, I think that's something that we could certainly take a look at for the report, whether there's a fit there. I know that while there's an oversupply of elementary education teachers, we have an undersupply of science and math teachers, particularly for high school and middle school. So, we could clearly look at the possibility of including some data and information about that in the report. That could be very, very relevant and useful, I think.
Madam Chair, just on that point, too, Senator Weaker, we can identify through the DEED data where there's growing demand. It's much harder to identify where there's a supply question. So we can simply tell students, boy, job growth is expected to be 20% in this occupation, if you think about it. We don't know how many people may be being trained in those occupations. I mean, the teacher industry occupation is a little bit different because we know how many, potentially could know how many are in those programs. But
okay, proceed.
And then finally, I have underway an employer survey working with the University of Minnesota and asking employers about roughly the quality of the students that are coming out of our systems and what they think and how their students fit within their various occupations. And that will be part of the next report that's due out in a few months.
One more thing I'd add to this slide is one of the questions that you asked is what information is available to future students and when and where is it available about the type and level of education required for fast-growing professions. And there's some important resources here in the state. There's MIN Careers. That's something that publication put out by the Department of Economic Development. MINCES, MCIS, Minnesota Career Information System, is an online tool that schools can subscribe to. It's a national consortium that provides really great information about job opportunities and degree alignment. And then there's iSEEK, and that's a state-funded effort that provides information about careers for prospective students, too. And we try to provide those links on our website. I think we have those on our website so that students can find out that information.
Madam Chair, I think one of your questions was regional data as well. And we certainly have regional data, again, back to the deed data, on occupational demand and supply, if you will, across different regions, the Northeast, Northwest, the metro area, et cetera. It's much harder on the education side because, you know, if a student goes to school at Duluth, may get a job in Minneapolis or in Bemidji State, may stay somewhere else. So students, once they graduate, are very mobile. So trying to align students and productions within a certain region is much harder than just the regional demand. And then a final question in this area that we were considering was the message that you don't need a four-year education or four-year degree to actually get a good job. We certainly talk about that all the time, dealing with either the Minsky two-year programs or the private for-profit schools that tend to issue certificates in something less than just a bachelor's degree. Mm-hmm. As far as developing a message along those lines, it's, I think that's kind of a joint effort amongst for everybody to consider. So,
and it seems like it should be not negatively stated, mm-hmm. like you don't need a four-year degree, but you do need post-secondary education.
Yes.
Madam Chair, what we try to say when I've talked to groups is we say that we now know that a high school education is not enough. You need something more than a high school diploma. You need a certificate, a two-year, a four-year degree, or more. Every bit of education that you get can add to, you know, a greater salary and more money during your lifetime. So we try to state it in a positive way.
Very quickly here, this is one of the indicators under degree attainment, proportion of population with at least an associate degree. We rank sixth, which is well above both the national average and the peer states, and frankly not that far away from some of the other states at the top. Gives you a sense of what we're talking about with the particular indicator.
Is there also an indicator that says instead of associate degree, at least a certificate? You know, or some college, or is there any ranking on that?
Madam Chair, not that we have currently in the report, although we do measure certificates when we look at all degrees.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair?
Senator Roble.
On that subject, if someone, yesterday someone made the comment, one of our speakers, that maybe we've turned our vocational programs into too high of a educational program or something instead of being more vocational oriented. And I know students who have gone to vocational schools and they've kind of set aside their general requirements and just jumped right into the trade classes, and they finished their trade classes and they were out of there and working on a job. And are they eligible to get their certificates when they do that, or do they have to complete so many general ed requirements before they can get a certificate?
You know, Madam Chair and
Senator
Roebling. Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, I don't know specifically the answer to that. I think it would really depend upon the certificate that you're talking about. Maybe there's somebody here from Minsky who could address that more specifically, but we can come back to you with a response. I don't have one today, though.
I'll have to hold that question for Minsky. Okay.
Madam Chair, then I'll move on to the next goal, Goal 3, which is essentially a learning outcomes goal. In our first report, this was empty. There was no indicators whatsoever. We didn't have any. The second one, we did add some, and I'll talk about those briefly. In my opinion, this is where the pressure is coming from places like the Spellings Commission, the Pat Callan people, the Dennis Jones. All the national folks are talking about learning outcomes and how can we demonstrate what students are learning in colleges. Of course, the faculty say that they can tell you what they're learning because they measure it every day in class. But it seems to be kind of a missing point for public policy discussion. So there are some assessment tools out there that schools and individual institutions are using right now. Three of them that we have in our report, the Collegiate Learning Assessment. There is currently in Minnesota 9 different schools using that. Quickly, Bethel, Carleton, St. Olaf, St. Ben, St. Cloud State, Metro State, St. Thomas, St. Scholastica, and McAllister. The second one called CAP, or Collegiate Assessment for Academic Proficiency. 6 schools there, although that's down from 2 years ago. And MAP, which is called the acronym for Measurement of Academic Proficiency and Progress. And there's 6 schools there as well, a couple 2-year schools. These are assessment tools for trying to measure general education capacities of students. The CLA is very interesting because it tries to measure both freshmen and senior students at these schools and try to evaluate or determinant of value added within each of the schools. They actually bring in outside data like socioeconomic background of students, SAT scores, things like that, which I think is a fascinating process because now you can actually compare between institutions. I saw St. Thomas's report just this morning, and they do very well compared to the rest of the schools across the country that use CLA. So it's these are all things that are in their initial stages, at least I believe, but institutions can use them, I think, to improve their processes at the local and institutional level. On student engagement, there's two pieces there. NESE, which is by engagement is what kind of roles do students play outside of the classroom? I mean, how often do they meet with teachers? How well do they participate in things within the institution? Because that does go to the academic side of things as well. There's both one for the four-year institutions and two-year institutions. There are 14 right now, 14 institutions across the state, two-year institutions that are using this, and 15 of the institutions that are using the NESE engagement survey method. I think many of Minsk's institutions actually use both of these. Then there's a couple other approaches that are being taken, something called the VSA, the Voluntary System of Accountability, and UCAN, which is put together by the independent schools. These are attempts, I think, to address some of these accountability demands that have been came out of the Spellings Commission and things like that. Where we try to fill in on the outcome side where data is available are things like GRE test scores, LSAT test scores, certificate test scores for nursing, things like that, or licensure. So they are outcome measures that can indicate something. We can do some comparisons with other states, but they're fairly narrowly focused in scope because they're tied just to those kinds of occupations. So we're kind of going down this outcomes path, but there's a long way to go. And again, on this employer satisfaction, this will inform some of this in the next report. Let me move on to, the chart simply shows you the GRE test scores and where Minnesota fits on verbal reasoning on the top half of the chart and then quantitative reasoning on the bottom half compared to the other states, peer states. You can see on the verbal reasoning, we tend to be fairly, we rank 13th, 14th in that range. On the quantitative side, we're much higher ranked, fourth. Second in 04 and 05, and then third in 05 and 06. So our kids are good at math, but not as good at the verbal reasoning, I suspect, is what that says. So let me move on then, Madam Chair. Members, to the fourth goal, which is research and discovery and contributing to the competitiveness in the global marketplace. I think there's a concern your part I suggested in the questions that we focused a bit too much on public education. And let me explain to you very quickly the three kind of goals we use for research and development. One is a very broad goal that looks at research across all areas, including the University of Minnesota, other private nonprofit institutions, the Mayo Clinic, and business as well. The fact of the matter is business swamps all the institutions, the academic institutions, as far as research and development. For instance, the university is in the range of $590 million of, I think, expenditures on R&D from the National Science Foundation money. Across the state, research development exceeds $5 billion, so they're roughly 10% of the total of the state. So that kind of gives you a sense. I mean, frankly, most of the R&D occurs in business. 3Ms of the world, Medtronics, things like that. So we try to start with that broad overarching kind of a goal. Then we take it down to the academic level, which focuses on the University of Minnesota and any other kind of academic programs. I mean, St. Thomas may get a $500,000 grant, for instance. They're in that pot because that's the way they're defined under the National Science Foundation. But we also include the Mayo Clinic because, frankly, they educate doctors and they draw down lots of NIH money. They look an awful lot like the medical school at the U of M. We think it's appropriate to include them. And they bring in roughly $200 million a year in research money. So it's a lot of funds that have gone down at the Mayo Clinic. So we include them, so it's kind of a level below this overarching level. And we show ranks and share. Share is an important point. There's roughly $45 billion, it's $49 billion across the country in R&D expenditures. In this state, we have, I think it's about 1.25% of that. If you can move that simply by 10 percentage points, 10 basis points, it's an additional $50 million into the state's economy. So moving a share a very little bit generates lots of money for economic activity. And then third, we look at rankings at the University of Minnesota itself. These come out of a group down at Arizona State. It's a nationally recognized group. And then we also include some rankings from international institutions as well. Shanghai University in China is one that's fairly well received. The Times of London does one. So we try to include lots of other rankings as well to give you some indication of where the university fits, because they have as a public goal they're an aspiration that top three in the country, I'm sorry, in the world of public institutions. And then secondly, on the workforce training side, we do include information on workforce development, customized training that comes out of the MinSTU system. So we try to deal with both aspects as far as being competitive. The other things about being competitive, I think we deal with in some of the other goals, degree production, things like that. I think you asked the question, or one was posed, about whether something was missing. I think if I had anything to identify that's missing, is this translation between research and actual production of the company. How often does that occur? What's that process look like?
What do you do that, like measuring patents?
That would be one way of doing it, man. I'm sure we actually talked about that initially. We were concerned that, unfortunately, that if you want to measure patents, you just need more patent attorneys and you'd get there. But so there's always kind of issues about measuring things. But that was one of the conversations that we had about 3 years ago.
When you look at workforce development, are you including, or is it appropriate to include any of the for-profit schools? Because they advertise that they have, you know, they're big on job placement and respond to the marketplace.
Mitri, you raise an excellent point. We have dealt very well with the for-profit schools. They are as nimble as they come. And I think it's to the extent that we could identify a measure for them would inform this report.
Okay. Madam Chair, that is an area that we've talked about. If there are things that you would like to see us do or there are things that are missing, please bring those to our attention, because as we said, the report is a work in progress.
Okay. Madam Chair, this slide just simply shows you the academic research share and rank where with the peer states. So roughly one. This is back in 2004. Our next report will be up to 2006. Fact of the matter is we're never going to get to where California, Texas, and New York are. Even if standardize it for things like share, they are just too well established. It's very hard to move this number. What's your share of research? It's simply because it's so competitive. And I'm sure people from the University of Minnesota could tell you that as well.
Madam Chair, Tricia Grimes with the Office of Higher Education. On Goal 5 is about providing access, affordability, and choice for all students. We provide information. One measure of access is whether students enroll. And so we provide some information on enrollment and compare that to other states, the rate of enrollment for students of various ages. We have some information on net prices, which are in particular net tuition and fees. So it looks at tuition and fees minus all grants and scholarships. And then we have one called affordability, where we take the way that grants and scholarships are spread across incomes and look at them for students in each system. And basically what it shows is that we have succeeded with financial aid in that the price after grants and scholarships to students at the low end of the income distribution is lower than it is to students at the higher end of the income distribution. However, it is still a very substantial portion of family income. We also look at borrowing patterns, and generally we find over and over again that Minnesota students are a little more likely to borrow than the national average, and they borrow somewhat more money than students nationally do. And then we will be having a survey. We have a survey that's going in its preparation stages now that will be more about specific information about how Minnesota students and families pay for post-secondary education. This is the slide that shows that where we looked at how tuition and fees plus a $10,000 amount for living allowance, which is different from what we use in the state grant program, but it's the average of what students actually spend. And then you subtract all the grants and scholarships. On average, this is how it looks across income for dependent students. And you can see that it is lower at the left-hand side of the income distribution, but it still does amount to substantial net prices for people.
Madam Chair, just to comment on this chart. This is, I think, one of the most important charts that we do in our office. I call it the reality test. Mm-hmm. This is what is the real sticker price for students and what they pay? What's a reasonable living and miscellaneous allowance amount? And we've done some comparisons with expenditure data from Bureau of Labor Statistics to back up the $10,000 figure that Ms. Grimes mentioned. And then we take out all the grants. We take out Pell Grant. We take out State Grant. We take out institutional aid. We take out anything that we can identify and says that would be a net offset to that sticker price in a living allowance. So for a student that's somewhere, you know, $10,000 or less, the net price at the top line there, that's the private for-profits, the nonprofits are about the same place. It's a $15,000 ticket that they're looking at on average. It doesn't mean that all students are there. They may get actually a lower amount. But this gives you a sense of what families have to face in reality, in the real world, when they're trying to send their child off to school.
Madam Chair, you know, this brings up an issue. You know, for example, here it shows that the net price for students at the public sector is down at the $10,000 range is around $7,000. Now, the question is that affordable? That's a substantial price for a family at that kind of income level, but it's not the kind of thing that lends itself easily to a grade of A, B, or C. So that's one of the reasons that so far our agency has not chosen to go to a grading system.
Madam Chair, then I'm going to the next chart, if we can get there, has to do with our budget, our internal budget on accountability. Mm-hmm. In the 05 session, there was $100,000 the first year for 06 and then $300,000 the second year ongoing. This was a case that we had made back then. We thought, given information from people like Pat Callan, that $300,000 to purchase things like the CLA test scores, to hire people like Dennis Jones like that, is what we needed. At the same time, if you recall, we got a $100,000 National Governors Association grant, so we had some money left over in the last biennium on this. And this is where the money goes, staff, assessment data, as I mentioned. We put on an assessment conference back in December of 07. We have to pay for some surveys and other kinds of professional contracts. We had hired a full-time person to do this work a year and a half or 2 years ago. He's since left the agency, but we got the first two reports done. So we have a lot of the upfront work is done. Last year, last session, we took $25,000 out of this budget to help cover some of the budget cuts that we had to face back then. And then given some salary savings for the unallotments that are just took place under the governor's order in the last couple of weeks, we took another $100,000. So right now we have $175,000 budget. So we're well down from the $300,000. And what we've done is just try to be more efficient. We have more people in the office picking up pieces of this thing and getting the work done. So you'll see the same kind of an outcome that you've had in the past. In fact, with our survey information, I think we're actually going to produce better things for less money.
Well, that was really quick. Thank you for doing that, because this was supposed to be more like an hour and a half meeting. And maybe we'll just take a couple more minutes for Ms. Grimes to just talk about the national report card on measuring up. And then we'll have to return to these reports, I think, in the future for more in-depth study.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you. I wonder if I could ask one question before we move on. And I apologize, as the newest member, I'm still trying to get my head around some of these numbers and where we stand. But either Ms. Hegart or Mr. McCandless. I'm sorry, what?
Ms. Chicanis.
Thank you. Where does Minnesota fall in terms of affordability nationally? You know, we were talking about the $7,000 and $15,000 benchmark, you know, after all the other mechanisms are taken away for closing the gap. Where do we fall nationally?
Is that going to be now in the measuring up report?
Very
good segue.
Thank you.
You should have just received a handout that looks like this that has a two-page version of the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education does a report card on all 50 states. There's a two-page version. There's also a 16-page version of the one for Minnesota. Then there's the report for nationally, and there's an 80-page technical report. There's a lot of information behind all this. So I'm just going to hit this once over lightly. They do give a grade in each area. They gave Minnesota a B in preparation and participation, an F in affordability, and the reason they gave the 49 states were given an F in affordability. And only California was given a C-. That's the only one that got a grade other than F. And in this case, the main reason behind the grade on affordability was that in the last 10 to 15 years, most states have increased tuition and have not increased grants and scholarships as much as they have increased tuition. Mm-hmm. However, their affordability indicator has some problems. It takes aid money that's really targeted to low-income students and averages it out across students for all incomes, and then subtracts it for students that are just from the lowest 40%. They do that out of necessity because there isn't a nice, handy indicator for all 50 states. Minnesota actually has been a leader in trying to work with the National Center for Education Statistics on getting affordability data that's valid at the state level. And Minnesota was one of 12 states that got some additional affordability information in 03-04, and we'll get it again in 07-08 when the data is released. But it's only available so far in a limited number of states. Because Minnesota has higher tuition than many other states, on affordability indicators, we don't always come out as well, particularly if those affordability indicators don't account for the fact that we tend to target what financial aid we give to the low-income students. On completion,
just a minute,
they gave...
Ms. Grimes, Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Grimes, I was intrigued. You said 49 states received an F?
Yes.
But I had recently talked to a senator in Georgia, and through their lottery, any student that has a B average, it's free. Private school as well. I think it's capped at just under 10,000. How could they get enough?
It's merit-based.
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, that's an excellent question. This particular report card sets a lot of store by how low-income students fare on that kind of thing, and that is a form of aid that's available to all incomes. And you're right. It's hard for me to understand how they could give Georgia an F also, but they did. On completion, they gave Minnesota an A based on basically that 60% of our college students complete bachelor's degrees, although they noted that there is a discrepancy between races. It's interesting because Minsky and the university all seem to think they still need to increase their graduation rates and their retention rates, even though we are getting a good grade nationally. On benefits, that's things like how many vote, how many bachelor's degrees you have in your economy, helping produce higher incomes, that kind of thing. And on learning, they gave all 50 states an incomplete. It is true there is no one measure of learning that applies to all 50 states. You wouldn't necessarily want one measure of learning to apply to the student who's in a computer repair class that would be the same as the one that would apply to a student that's in a pre-med set of courses. Director Hegard and Mark Misukanis were saying, in our report, we have pages 30 to 39 have a fair amount of information about learning assessment, but trying to provide that on a national level where you can just do a handy grade on data that's the same for all states is just not available at this point in time. I gave it a once over.
You did a great job. This is a very interesting report. You summarized it in 5 minutes. Why do you think our preparation at grade, even though it's a B, it has a downward arrow?
Madam Chair, they're saying that over time that they don't think we have improved the percentage of students taking advanced placements exams enough compared to other states. But this is one where Dr. Callen himself commented on it when he was in Minnesota in May 2005. Nationally, there's not an indicator that shows students taking things like post-secondary enrollment options, and college in the schools, and international baccalaureate kinds of classes. And so we may not have as many students taking advanced placement tests as other states do, partly because those students are taking college-level courses in other ways. So that's sort of an example of how one national indicator will base it on just one little piece of data and not look at the fuller picture of what may be going on at the state level.
Okay, well, thank you all very much for our whirlwind meeting. And the meeting's adjourned. 25 minutes.